This is ARRL's Eclectic Tech, a bi-weekly look at the technical and scientific side of amateur radio with your host Steve Ford, WB8IMY. Eclectic Tech is brought to you by ICOM. ICOM, for the love of ham radio, is about the passion for an incredible hobby. Visit ICOM in the community webpage at www.icomamerica.com/community.
Here's an exercise. Try going to Google, or whatever your favorite search engine may be on the internet, and enter Schumann resonance. Now I'll spell Schumann for you. S-C-H-U-M-A-N-N. I tried this recently and ended up with a lot of links to what scientists derisively call New Age hokum, or just woo. You'll see these references to Schumann resonance being the so-called heartbeat of our planet, with amazing abilities to cure disease and alter consciousness itself if only we could tap into its incredible power. But is Schumann resonance a real thing? Surprisingly, the answer is yes. It all begins with lightning. Flashes of lightning strike around the Earth about 50 times every second, believe it or not, and these discharges create electromagnetic waves at extremely low frequencies. The waves were named after Wiedfried Otto Schumann, in honor of his work on global resonances that he was doing back in the mid-1950s. First measured, however, in the early 1960s, the signal itself is centered at 7.83 hertz, and it has progressively weaker harmonics that pop up at 14.3, 20.8, 27.3, and 33.8 hertz. The resonances fluctuate with variations in the ionosphere, with the intensity of solar radiation playing a major part. The world's lightning hotspots in Asia, Africa, and South America also influence the strength of the resonance. To detect and measure these waves, you need a specialized receiver and quite a large antenna, as you can imagine, for that wavelength. Scientists have been measuring the Schumann resonance for several decades now because there are still some unanswered questions about how the signals form, I mean why at 7.83 hertz, for example, and how they propagate. There is also scientific interest in how Schumann resonances might, big might, affect biology. Life on Earth, after all, evolved in the presence of these signals, and some scientists wonder if they could have an effect. At this point, I need to raise a warning flag. There is serious research taking place in this area, but there's also a phenomenal amount of woo. On the serious side, well, a 2006 study found that the frequencies may be related to different kinds of brain waves. The researchers described, quote, real-time coherence between variations in the Schumann resonance and brain activity spectra within the 6 to 16 hertz band, unquote. Authors of a 2016 paper from the Behavioral Neuroscience Laboratory of Canada's Laurentian University discovered that 238 measurements from 184 individuals over a 3.5-year period, quote, demonstrated unexpected similarities in the spectral patterns and strengths of the electromagnetic fields generated by the human brain and the Earth ionospheric cavity, unquote. This all exists in the realm of real science, and research is continuing. But if you go looking for this topic yourself, just be sure to use a very strong woo filter. You'll stumble across all sorts of claims about Schumann resonance. Just remember the quote popularized by Carl Sagan, extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence. With our technical chops, hams are pretty well positioned to dabble in this research. If you're a member of the IEEE, you can access the article Design of Schumann Resonance Generator and Detector that was published back in the October 2017 proceedings of the International Symposium on Electromagnetic Compatibility. It's pretty interesting stuff. I'm speaking with Grant Connell, WD6CNF. I was about to say good afternoon, Grant, but I guess it's good morning your time, right?
That's still 11 o'clock here.
Well, Grant is known among many in the amateur radio community for his work in software in particular. In fact, he has a website at www.hotamateurprograms.com where he offers a number of his free programs for Windows. And I'll put the link to that in our Eclectic Tech podcast archives there for episode 37. I was just visiting there not long ago, in fact, Grant, and I saw something that was unfamiliar to me, so I had to download it. It was called CWTY?
That's correct.
And it's I haven't had much time to play with it, but it seems to be like a remarkable little Morse decoder program.
It's an expansion of the CW decoder program that I wrote about 10, 12 years ago, but I wanted to give the program better transmit capabilities. So I extended the CW alphabet to be the keyboard. So you can have like an RTTY conversation with people with parentheses and all the special punctuation marks, everything else. And there's a Morse code sequence that corresponds to that character. And that operates even all the way up to, even though the characters are a little longer, they're 5 to 6 characters long, tits and das. And that'll operate all the way up to 100 words a minute without losing a character. So I wanted to have a little bit of an upgrade to Morse code.
Well, I've managed to do some decoding with it just briefly, and it worked remarkably well. In fact, it... For lack of a better word, it seemed to kind of learn or adapt as it was decoding signals. Is that a reasonably accurate way to put it?
That's right. You know, it has to adjust to the code speed of the operator. So it has to have a few dits and dahs to get the timing correct. As the higher in speed you go, the shorter the dits and dahs go. So it builds up a little memory to determine just how long those are so that it can set the code speed. And then by setting the code speed, it sets the filter inside the program to optimize for that code speed.
Okay. Well, it was after I had looked at your website, Grant, that I jumped over and went to QRZ.com and was looking at your page and was amazed at all of the photographs of your antennas, both indoor and out, and the story behind it and all that. And what is that story? You live with rather serious antenna restrictions, correct?
I've lived within antenna restrictions for quite a while. It actually started in 1992 when I moved from San Jose to Livermore, California. And I moved into a nice new house, good neighborhood, but they had antenna restrictions. So then I didn't know what to do. I wanted to keep in touch with my friends in the Bay Area, and I needed some way to do that. So I started looking around and found that I had some attic space. And then I started building some small antennas, you know, to be able to see if I could get in touch with my friends back down in San Jose. And that's about 40, 45 miles away. And to my surprise, I was able to build small antennas that did the job. And then I, of course, built some verticals and operated the repeaters in the area. And I was able to reach the antennas there, stations with the repeaters with small verticals. So I discovered that the roof tiles weren't that much of a problem, even up to 2 meters.
I was wondering about that. Are those slate, or what sort of roof tiles are those?
The older homes have the tiles that are petroleum-based type kind of tiles, the regular tiles. And the new homes have a variety of different type of ceramic-type tiles. And they're like pottery, and so they break. But you can get them flat or round, depending on the house style. So the question was, you know, how bad is it for RF? And it turns out they're actually pretty easy because, especially in the Phoenix area, it's pretty dry. And so there's not a lot of moisture in there, so radio waves can go right through the tile.
Now, your attic looks a lot like mine, with rafters going every which way. And in your photographs, it almost looks like you have these antennas more or less sandwiched between the rafters. Is that right?
That's correct. And that's actually a fairly recent development. I used to just stick the antennas where the rafters weren't. And they usually have about 4 to 6 feet of space available. You could put a small antenna in there. But I also discovered that along the center line of the roof of this house, it's a fairly large house, 3,600 square feet, single story. The rafters went vertically. So I decided that I wanted to be able to reach out a little farther. And so I put the antennas through the rafters and doubled my antenna length from about 4 feet to 8 feet. And but then I had to have one going mostly to the northern hemisphere and mostly to the southern hemisphere. So it took two antennas, but they're bigger. And I was able to rotate them maybe 100, 120 degrees and get coverage. And that worked fine for the Phoenix area. I have it mostly, Phoenix is to the north, northwest of me, and Tucson group are to the south of me. So that worked out just fine for that situation.
It looks like I'm seeing a 1296 Loop Yagi in there too.
Yes, that's a commercial Yagi from one of the vendors, and I decided not to tackle the tight dimensions required for operation at that frequency.
And how far is that attic above the ground, would you say?
I would say the average antenna height that you can put in there is about 17 feet. Having such a large house with the tiles required a little higher apex, so the apex of the house is about 20 feet. And my attic height is around 15 to 17 feet.
Now, of course, the big question, Grant, this being UHF and VHF inside an attic, how well do they work?
So HF, not so well. I did put a 40, 15, and 10-meter multi-strand dipole up there. And although I was able to receive stations, one of the disadvantages of being up there in the attic is that you're coexisting with house wiring. And it turns out nowadays with all the hash and devices, the house wiring provides you a wonderful S9 signal. So even though I could hear stations, the big gun stations across the country, the weaker stations weren't feasible. And also those attic members will detune your antennas so they don't operate very well. You know, it's hard to get the SWR down low enough to you can do it with antenna tuning, but you've got a detuned structure. Now on VHF and UHF, surprisingly, 6 meters is I can talk all the way across country. I've talked to the East Coast with a two element hex beam. Huh. And on 2 meters, I can talk directly down to Tucson. I've talked over to Lake Havasu from my location. It's about 250, 300 miles. And I've talked up to Flagstaff, which is about 150 miles. So in 2 meters, I can even go 150 miles. But I also operate like some 1296 and a 440 for the local repeaters or the local ham groups.
Now, among your collection of photos, and they're very nice photos too, by the way. Again, I encourage listeners to go look at your profile on QRZ.com. But I see a number of really intriguing outdoor antennas, loops, and I think a cobweb, maybe a 6 meter quad as well.
That's correct. I like to operate the full spectrum, HF and VHF and UHF, and VHF and UHF, you get the rag chew, talk to people on antennas, and there's lots of people building EME stations, a couple of them around me. And so you get to talk about antennas, transmitters, homebrew equipment, and the general good old ham stuff. But for outside DX, I had a real problem in that I couldn't put a dipole up. And so I didn't know what to do. And so I started a journey of, thank God for the web. There were a lot of web articles on different types of antennas. And one of them happened to be the loop or the small transmitting loop, the STL type of antenna. And I started experimenting with small versions of that and built up to larger versions. And read some more work on what made them work, what didn't make them work. And I discovered that by having bigger copper tubes and paralleling the tubes, that you could improve the efficiency of those antennas to pretty much like operate like dipoles. So then I put them on rotors. And so now I basically have antennas that act like dipoles that I can rotate. And I've got up to 78 countries for my DXCC.
Wow. And does that pose a problem in terms of your homeowner restrictions, those being out there?
No, because I have a 6-foot fence and those things are about 6 foot high.
Okay.
I do push it a little bit with the cobweb. The neighbor behind me has a trampoline set with these webbing and these arms that go up. And guess what they look like? They look like the cobweb. So I figured, you know, he's not going to say too much about my cobweb, and I won't say too much about his trampoline.
Well, they're beautifully put together, the antennas. They all appear to be using black material or spray painted black. Was that a deliberate choice?
So I use copper tubing, the kind you can get for refrigeration systems for your air conditioning, and I spray paint them black. My wife actually wanted me to have them copper colored. They're very shiny copper, and she wanted me to shellac them and have them be bright copper. And let me tell you, they are really bright, and I just did not want to bring all that attention to me.
No, that makes perfect sense. And they're on rotators as well, did you say?
That's correct. All those antennas are on rotors, even the cobweb, because the cobweb does have, which, you know, a cobweb is really a dipole, and it's a multi-strand arrangement. And they have about 2-3 dB more gain in one direction in the front than they do in back, along with, you know, good side lobe. They don't reduce the side lobes as much as a dipole does. So most people don't rotate the cobwebs, but I want that extra 2 or 3 dB again.
Sure. And do you remote tune the loops, or are they fixed more or less?
Oh, the loops have to be tuned. So I run a multi-conductor cable for the rotor, and there are a couple of extra lines in the rotor cable that can be used for driving a motor, which drives the tuning capacitor. So they're tuned to the frequency of operation remotely.
I could have looked at the captions on your photo for this, but I might as well ask you now. And that was, how many outdoor antennas do you have now, and for which bands?
Well, I have actually, five outdoor antennas. I have an HF receive loop from MFJ that provides me general coverage from, you know, broadcast band up to 30 megahertz. And although I had built my own, I like their preamplifier better than mine, but it did work. Building a wideband preamp is a good exercise. And then I have two major loops that are large for efficiency. One of them covers 40 and 80 meters. The other loop covers 20 meters, 15 meters, and 17 meters. And then the cobweb has a little bit of an overlap. It covers 20 meters, 15 meters, and 12 meters. And then 6 meters is just too big for the attic. So I have a 6-meter, 3-element quad.
Well, you're a testimony to what can be done under difficult situations. I mean, granted, you have the outdoor space with the privacy fence, but you've done astonishing work in your attic as well.
The attic antenna was actually a progressive kind of development. When I first moved to the Phoenix area, I had no idea what the activity was for the amateur community. And it turns out this is the area where a lot of hams come to retire. And so there is a good amount of amateur activity on 6 meters, on 223.5, on 2 meters, on 440, and 1296. So as I discovered these different groups, I upgraded my ham shack to the Icon 9700 that gave me 440 and 1296. And then I started building antennas to be able to be part of all these groups who are operating there. And we have a lot of activities there. I don't get on too much of the 1010 nets, but I do get on all the other VHF and UHF nets.
In addition to all of your antenna work, do you think you'll be authoring more software for hams?
The only software addition I would have would be modification to the CWTY program. I'm impressed with operating WSJT on FT8. And I think I would like to make it a little more versatile in its interface, just like WSJT, make it easier to operate, like push a button to log for LOTW and things like that. So I will extend that program for the convenience of logging, and you know, that way you don't have to have an extra log program to log your contacts. I will expand on that.
Well, that would make sense.
Well, I encourage everyone to be able to get out and operate. As you know, we're all, many hams now are have the antenna restrictions, and it's severely limited our ability to operate on the bands. And I kind of wanted to show that you can buy antennas or build antennas, especially I operate high power, so I had to build my antenna. You couldn't buy high power antennas in general for the HF bands and the mag loops. So there are a few, but you can do that, and you can reach out to the world, because I've operated FT8 less than 2 years, and I've got WAS on 40 and 20 meters with small magnetic loops, only 5 feet in diameter. And everybody can get on the air and do that. It's not a really difficult job. And you can practice your hobby and still be able to reach out. I've been a DX fan since I've started way back in 1962. Like I said, I was devastated when I got here and couldn't do anything. So I encourage all amateurs to be able to do their hobby. And ATIC is a good resource for antennas. I mean, if you only have a handheld with a handheld antenna, you can put something up in the ATIC, a small four-element beam, and you can then talk to your Peters and people that are part of the community around you, and you can still operate and exercise your hobby.
A lot of listeners are going to find this not only useful, but encouraging.
Well, I hope that they get inspired. I have inspired several other people here in the area to put up antennas in their attics, and they're now a part of the group.
Well, hopefully I'll work you via your attic system one of these days.
Oh, well, that's a little tougher. How about my outside antennas?
There you go. Thank you, Grant.
Nice chatting with you.
Tune in again for the next episode of Eclectic Tech, produced by ARRL, the National Association for Amateur Radio. Music is provided by Purple Planet at purpleplanet.com. If you have comments, email eclectic@arrl.org. This episode is copyright ARRL, and all rights are reserved. I'm Sabrina Jackson, KC1JMW. See you next time.